calculations that have been done to see whether this conjecture is right. There's actually a fairly long history of that. And so in order to keep you from being bored, I'll mostly tell you about sort of the early numerical simulations done mostly by Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief. And then I'll tell you about some of the later simulations. And then I will conclude with sort of what should be done next. And just to sort of get a little bit ahead of myself, one of the things that should be done next is to numerically investigate what are called null singularities. And one of the purposes of my visit here is to get advice from Luis Lehner about methods to use to do that. And so that part, at least, has been very helpful to me in the sense that I've gotten lots of good advice from Luis, and I think I'm ready to gear up and go ahead and tackle that one. Okay, but that's getting way ahead of myself, so let me start at the beginning. One of the things that we do when we teach introductory physics is that we tell the students that when something is I'll get to why I'm pointing to that in a second. No, you're one of the students. I'm going to use your this coffee cup as a demonstration. Is that yours or yours? Okay. So one of the things that we tell the students is that when an object is not moving, that doesn't mean that there aren't any forces on it. It just means that the forces are in balance. Right? So, I could always drop this to show the force of gravity, but I won't do that because I might break the cup. So now, with the cup, oh, wait a minute, hang on a second, got to put it back on the table for a second. So now, with a cup on the table, right, the cup is not moving, and that doesn't mean there's no force on it because gravity is a universal force, and so the force of gravity is pulling it down. But it does mean that their net force on it is zero. So there's an equal and opposite force pushing it up, in this case, the normal force from the table. So one of the things that we usually don't tell the students is why it is that these forces are perfectly in balance. How does the table know to push up with exactly the same force that gravity is pulling the cup down with? Usually the students are under the misimpression that this has something to do with Newton's third law about equal and opposite forces. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with that at all. The main point is that table, although it looks rigid, actually has some give to it, just like this thing. And so on this, if I push down, what it does is to exert a force proportional to the amount it's compressed. And so things sink into it until the force that it gets from being compressed is just enough to balance things out. So in other words, the cup is balanced not because of action and reaction, but because even rigid-looking tables are really like a bunch of springs. You push them until they're compressed enough to resist the force. Okay, so that long-winded introduction, now you can have your cup back, that long-winded introduction is part of yet another introductory remark about stars, right? So exactly the same sort of thing occurs in the case of a star, right? A star is held in equilibrium by the competition between its own self-gravity pulling it in and the pressure that it exerts from various forces, from hot gas, from degeneracy pressure, things like that, pushing out. And so you might think that this situation is just the same as it is in the case of the sort of cup on the table, namely that whatever the star is made of, as you compress it, it's going to exert greater and greater pressure. And finally, it will come to a point where the pressure it exerts outward balances its own self-gravity as it comes inward, and it will come to balance. But there's an extra property that stars have that makes this whole question a little bit more dicey. And that's that it's true that while the material of the star exerts greater pressure as you compress it. It's also true that because gravity is a 1 over r squared force, that as you compress the star, the gravity that it needs to resist also becomes bigger. So it's not at all clear that stars will ever come to equilibrium. Maybe the star could shrink more and more, and at every stage it exerts greater pressure to try to resist gravity, but at every stage the gravity that it's trying to resist is big enough that it can't, and finally the whole star could shrink down to a point. So at this point, this has nothing to do with general relativity. Precisely this phenomenon is what Chandrasekhar found in the 1930s when he found the Chandrasekhar limit. For white dwarf matter, it has precisely this property that once the mass is sufficiently big, and just using, you know, plain old Newtonian gravity, that as the white dwarf gets smaller and smaller, the amount of force that it needs to overcome is too big for the pressure that it can exert at that size to overcome. And at least within Newtonian gravity, you would get the prediction that the thing collapses down to a point. Okay, so that's basically the idea of gravitational collapse. Gravity gets stronger as things get compressed, and even though pressure gets stronger, one can envision situations where no matter how small the thing gets, the gravity is stronger than the pressure and the thing continues to collapse. Okay, now, this sort of simple Newtonian story was given sort of an extra twist by some results due to Penrose and Hawking and various other people that usually go under the name of singularity theorems. And what the singularity theorems basically say is that once you form a trap surface, where a trap surface is a surface where gravity is so strong that even light can't escape from it, And given some conditions on the energy of the matter that you're using and some conditions that basically say you can't travel backwards in time, what you find is that once you form a trap surface, you have to form a singularity, where in this case, a singularity only means that some observer or light ray ends in a finite amount of time. Now, these singularity theorems are really great and powerful in the sense that they give you these very general circumstances for singularity formation. You don't have to, you know, solve any detailed field equations. You don't have to, you know, assume any symmetry. All it says is that as long as, you know, matter is sufficiently reasonable there aren't any time machines, then once you form a trap surface, you're going to form a singularity. Well, right. So it's really a theorem in differential geometry. So the idea is that all statements about the stress energy are really statements, you know, once you assume the Einstein field equations, are really statements about the Ricci tensor. So you can forget about general relativity and just say that, you know, provided that you know, space-time is described by a metric and the Ricci tensor satisfies the following things, then a trap surface has to lead to the formation of a singularity. Now, you might have a theory that's, you know, not described by a metric tensor, for example, or you might have a theory where it's basically general relativity with sort of funny matter fields or other couplings to curvature, so that, you know, particular properties of the stress energy tensor no longer give you the corresponding properties for the Ricci tensor. Well, but that's what I'm saying. This is really the condition is basically the that you use for this is basically the null energy condition, right? So that's basically the one that says that the stress energy dotted twice into a null vector is always greater than or equal to zero. So from the Einstein field equations, that's basically the same as the statement that the Ricci tensor dotted twice into a null vector is so basically the idea is that you have a metric, and then The question is whether your field equations and whatever matter you're using enforce the condition that the Ricci tensor dotted twice into the null vector is always greater than or equal to zero. If so, you have the singularity theorems, and if not, then you don't. It's additional, right? So a trap surface means that you have some surface where even the outgoing light rays get dragged back in. So basically, if you look at the equations for light rays, what positive Ricci tensor gives you is that gravity tends to focus light rays. So it's basically a focusing condition, right? You have
because whenever I have a trap surface, that automatically means on one side I have focusing light rays.
So if you have a trap surface, what that means is that even the outgoing light rays are being dragged inwards. But what you need the energy condition for is basically to ensure that that continues to happen, and therefore that they'll be dragged inward and finally hit, right? Otherwise, you could imagine something where initially the light rays are focusing inward, but now some powerful anti-gravity machine makes them defocus and everything's fine again. So that's why you need that condition. So it's two separate conditions. The trap surface says even the outgoing light rays are focusing inward now, and the null energy condition basically says that once they start to focus, they will continue to focus because gravity only makes focusing stronger. Okay, so this is a nice, very general result, but on the other hand, the thing that's not nice about it is that it tells you almost nothing about the nature of the space-time singularities. All it tells you is that, for some unspecified reason, at some time, some observer or light ray ends, right? Doesn't say which ones, doesn't say why they end, doesn't say what they encounter to make them end. So you sort of assume that, well, you're forming this trap surface, and this trap surface is, perhaps inside a black hole, and anything that enters the black hole is going to be crushed by infinite curvature on some singularity, right? That's the sort of the folklore that goes along with these theorems. But the theorem itself says no such thing. All it says is something's going to happen to someone. Don't know what, don't know who, but, something bad is going to happen. Right. So yeah, spaghettification. Right. So that's right. So as he says, right. I mean, the basic idea is that tidal forces tend to pull in one direction and compress in another. So if you're falling in, you get spaghettified. Although actually, as I'll show you later, it turns out that it's less spaghetti and more taffy. One of these days, right, if you haven't done so, you should come, as tourists to nearby Michigan. And if you do and visit the town of Frankenmuth, you'll see a whole bunch of taffy machines. And what taffy machines do in order to mix the taffy is they first stretch in one direction and they rotate things around and stretch in another direction. And it turns out that singularities actually do that. So it's a little bit more complicated than spaghettifying. It's really a taffy pull. Right, it's a taffification. yeah, that's kind of a caramel candy. Right, it's pretty tasty, but it can do bad things to your teeth, especially if you have any braces or other dental appliances. So keep your teenage kids away from it. Right. Right. Okay, so that's the situation, right? I mean, Penrose and Hawking give us these wonderful theorems that tell us singularities form, but they tell us absolutely nothing about what singularities are like. So we'd like to know what they're like, and in particular, we'd like to know, whether any of this sort of folklore that we all say about singularities is actually true. So you might think that, well, this is going to be a really complicated question to answer because, after all, singularities are some property of the Einstein field equations. The Einstein field equations are these, sort of complicated nonlinear equations with lots of terms in them. You know, we can get a few exact solutions, but, you know, sort of other than that, you know, our tools are things like, you know, perturbation theory, which is not going to help very much near a singularity because things are getting really strong, not really weak. And so you might think that, well, you know, this is going to be a really complicated question, a really complicated problem. It's going to have some really complicated answer. But you can easily convince yourself that that need not be the case, right? The answer might be very simple. And the reason is that even though Einstein's equation has a whole bunch of complicated nonlinear terms in it, as you get towards a singularity, if this notion that curvature is blowing up is true, then some terms in the equation should be blowing up. And they'll, different terms, you know, perhaps will blow up at different rates. So what that means is that if you want to see what singularities are like, all you really need is to keep track of whichever terms are blowing up the fastest. Those are the important ones. Throw everything else away. Now you have a truncated set of field equations, much simpler than the original ones. Just see what its solutions look like, and then you're done. Okay? Now, so things might be okay. They might be simple. But the question is sort of, you know, how are you supposed to sort of turn this into an actual research program? And the idea is that what you're supposed to do is to make a guess as to which terms in the equation are the most important. You're supposed to verify that that guess actually is consistent with the field equations, and then you're supposed to see what the solution of those simplified equations look like. So this is exactly what was done by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz back in the 60s and 70s. And basically, their ansatz is the following. What they're assuming is that as you get near a singularity, the derivatives in spatial directions become unimportant compared to the derivatives in the time direction. So what that means is you get to, you sort of take Einstein's equation, you know, it looks like a complicated set of partial differential equations. Now you just throw away all the terms that have space derivatives in them. So that's great. Now you only have derivatives with respect to time. Things that only have derivatives with respect to time are ordinary differential equations. And furthermore, you know, since you're dealing with Einstein's equation, you just pick, you know, not just any ODEs, but whichever ones the equations give you, and those turn out to be sufficiently tractable that you can figure out what their solutions look like. What's that? Part of their conjecture is that singularities are space-like. And in fact, it follows from their ansatz. That's right. So in fact, right? I mean, you know, ages ago, when you know, one of these three, I forget which it was, gave a talk. I guess it was at Cambridge, and said, "Oh yeah, and we have the general behavior of singularities." You know, Hawking objected and said, "No, you have the general behavior of a family of singularities. You have no idea whether there are, you know, any other families that behave any differently." Okay, and in fact, you know, sort of that's the question. I mean, so there's an ansatz, it's consistent with the Einstein field equations, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way singularities behave. So the question is, you know, do they behave this way? And if so, how would we tell? Yeah.
It seems to me isn't it self-contradictory in a sense? Because you're saying that, basically, you want to ignore the spatial derivatives, right? Mm-hmm. So you're saying that different points evolve independently, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So then there's no communication between these. So nothing tells, so they could hit singularity at different times.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in principle, so there's nothing that tells you that if this guy hits singularity, this guy should hit singularity before the light has time to reach, basically, from this guy to this guy. Because you're completely disconnected all these different guys from each other.
Yeah.
Right? So what guarantees that the singularity will be a space-like?
Yeah, so that's an excellent objection. And actually, it is part of a form of what's perhaps an even more basic objection, which is that general relativity is coordinate invariant, you know, If I make a coordinate transformation that sort of mixes up space and time, then even if in some coordinate system the space derivatives were negligible, surely they won't be in some other coordinate system. So this conjecture only makes sense if you have a particular slicing. And the particular slicing that Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz had in mind was basically synchronous coordinates where time equals zero is on the singularity. So in their slicing, everybody does hit the singularity at the same time. The problem with using that kind of slicing, though, is that since the singularity is not supposed to be smooth, there's no particular reason to believe that a coordinate system based on the singularity is itself going to be smooth. So that was sort of another objection to their work. But anyway, these are definitely things to worry about, and in particular. This conjecture can only be right if you have in mind some particular way of slicing space-time. And so, before one says, well, you know, is this right, you have to say a few more words about, well, what slicing are you using? Okay, so anyway, this conjecture came about in the 60s and 70s. But people had no idea whether it was right or not. Maybe it's right, maybe it's not. How do you tell? Then in the 90s, Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief got the notion of, well, you know, why don't we just do some numerical simulations of the approach to the singularity and see if they agree with what BKL say. So as is usual with numerics, one usually first starts in some cases that have a fair amount of symmetry, and then you sort of work your way up to cases that have less and less symmetry, and finally you sort of look at the general case with no symmetry at all. So what they decided to study was this class of things called Gaudi spacetimes. So these have planar symmetry. They have symmetry in sort of two spatial directions. They're sort of closed cosmologies with space as a three torus. So you can think of this as being sort of gravity waves traveling around in a circle, interacting with each other, and eventually forming a singularity. These things are also vacuum spacetimes, and you might think that, well, that's sort of a little bit of a reach, because surely it's the collapse of matter and enormous densities that makes these gravitational singularities. But in fact, you can show using a simple example of a space which is homogeneous but anisotropic, so like cosmology but expanding at different rates in different directions, you can show that as you get near the singularity, that in fact the vacuum terms in the equation become more important than the matter terms. This usually goes by the slogan that matter doesn't matter. So when you're studying space-time singularities, you should be able to just look at the behavior of the vacuum Einstein equations and read off the behavior of singularities that way. Right, that's right. And later on, so it turns out that one exception to this is stiff fluids or scalar fields, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so the basic idea is we have planar symmetry. So these metric functions, p, q, and lambda, depend only on the time coordinate t and one spatial coordinate x, and the singularity is approached as t goes to infinity. So you want to think of t as being basically like logarithm of the amount of time to the singularity. Okay, so let's take a look at what the Einstein equations look like in this case. And I'm going to go ahead and show you how just by sort of staring at the Einstein field equations, you can first convince yourself that the BKL conjecture is likely to be true, and you can then convince yourself that the BKL conjecture is likely to be false. And having, you know, now convinced yourself of both possible answers to the question, one should now sort of do numerical simulations and see which one is right. Okay, so here's the argument that, the BKL conjecture is likely to be true for these spacetimes. So remember that the conjecture is that as you approach a singularity, the space derivatives become less important than the time derivatives. That doesn't mean, by the way, that spatial derivatives are getting small. All it means is that when you look at their role in the field equations, they become less important, mostly because in the field equations, they get multiplied by small quantities. So remember that this logarithmic coordinate t is going to infinity at the singularity. And now, in this notation, a subscript means derivative with respect to the corresponding variable. So this ptt means derivative of the metric function p twice with respect to time. Pxx is derivative of p twice with respect to x, and so on. So notice that every single term that has any spatial derivatives in it is multiplied by an e to the minus 2t, right? This particular coordinate, well, I mean, there are lots of ways of characterizing it. But one way that generalizes is that this slicing is harmonic slicing. The time coordinate is a solution of the wave equation. In fact, it seems likely that time coordinates that are solutions of the wave equation have this general behavior. But in any case, in this particular slicing, what's that?
From the previous lecture, you remember
we're looking at that coordinate's going bad. Well, but it's supposed to. So the idea is that especially if you're doing numerical simulations, you don't want your numerical simulation to suddenly go bad because everything's blowing up. There's also the issue that he raised about, well, what if things hit singularities at the singularity at different times? So ideally, what you would like is a time coordinate that approaches infinity as you approach the singularity. And that way, you can read off the behavior of the singularity as the asymptotic behavior of the solutions to your equations. In any case, with this time coordinate and the slicing, and the BKL conjecture always depends on picking a particular slicing, it does sort of look like every single spatial derivative has an e to the minus 2t multiplying it. Therefore, it seems likely that in the limit as t goes to infinity, that is, as we approach the singularity, that we could neglect those terms. Well, that's great, because now if we can neglect those terms, we go ahead and we get rid of those terms, we get a much simpler set of ODEs, so simple that we can actually solve it in closed form. OK, so that's the argument that the BKL conjecture is something we should expect to be true. Now let me give you the argument that we shouldn't expect it to be true. Wait a second. I've gotten ahead of myself. OK, so it turns out that when you just drop all the spatial derivative terms from this equation, just solve the time derivative terms, then you find that at late time, this metric function q goes to a spatially dependent constant, no time dependence, and this metric function p grows linearly. Okay, so now you should worry about the BKL conjecture being true, because of this one term in the equations, right? This term does have an e to the minus 2t, but it also has an e to the 2p. So if p is growing linearly with time, and if that growth is at a rate that's faster than 1, then rather than being negligible, this term will actually get enormous. You should worry that, here we have something that we sort of assume that maybe the BKL conjecture is right, and it led us to a sort of contradiction, because if p can grow faster than 1, then this term that by assumption we were supposed to neglect actually becomes more important than the terms that we're keeping. Yeah. Q has the time dependence of q basically goes to 0 as t goes to infinity. Right. That's sure. What's that?
It's Q, Q is arbitrary. I mean, it's sex dependence.
Right.
Could be anything.
Right. Right. Yes. And in particular, right, with arbitrary x dependence, there will be, you know, usually places where qx vanishes, and you know something funny might happen at those places. Okay. But so this is still in the realm of you know, sort of guessing just by staring at the equations. And Berger and Moncrief's basic notion was, well, you know, let's stop guessing, let's run a numerical simulation and see what happens. So they ran a numerical simulation, and what they found is that sure enough, p grows linearly with time, q goes to a constant, just as BKL thought, but there are spikes. And let me show you sort of what these results look like. So at some late time, this is what p looks like as a function of time. And this is what q looks like as a function of time. And these non-generic points are precisely the ones where qx goes to zero. The point is that every place where q is not equal, where qx is not equal to zero, the equations themselves will drive the velocity of p below one. But at those special points where qx is zero, that term is absent, and that those points and only those points, p can grow faster than one. And so as you get to the singularity, you get ever narrowing regions. In which you get this sort of nastier behavior. Now, I want to emphasize that things are going singular everywhere. The curvature is blowing up everywhere. It's not that, oh, this is really nasty behavior, so something's bad is happening just at these points. No, something bad is happening everywhere. But in particular, what's happening is that we're getting features that are on narrower and narrower spatial scales, right? Something that BKL did not predict. And that's a challenge both for mathematics and for numerical simulations of these things. Just a second. So for mathematics, because usually one wants sort of things that are smoother than this, not with these spikes. And for numerics, because if you're going to trust the numerics, you want to be able to resolve all features. And these features get narrower as you get closer and closer to the singularity, and therefore take more and more computer resources to resolve. Yeah?
So this is p as a function of x.
Yes. Yeah. P is a function of x at a time.
This is x or t?
This is x.
Okay.
Right. So this is p as a function of x at a particular time, a time that's sufficiently close to the singularity that you can see this sort of asymptotic behavior, but the asymptotic behavior includes these ever narrowing spikes. Okay, so the existence of these spikes was kind of a surprise, but other than that, everything else seemed to, you know, behave just the way BKL told us it was supposed to behave.
So on this scale, what's the size of the causally connected domain?
So it gets smaller and smaller. So basically, the sort of causal domains go like, I forget what let's see, yeah. So, I mean, they must go like proper time to some power, I forget exactly what. But this is a logarithmic time, so they basically, you know, sort of get exponentially small. So causal domains get smaller and smaller on in these coordinates as you get closer and closer to the singularity. So one of the reasons why you can have this sort of, you know, behavior where things seem to decouple, right? I mean, you think, well, this is crazy, you know, how is that possibly you know, consistent with causality? But they decouple for precisely the same reason that they decouple in cosmology, right? If you're closer and closer to the singularity and you're considering shorter and shorter timescales, you know, your sort of immediate light cone So, I mean, just as in cosmology, as you get closer to the Big Bang, you know, sort of light cones lose communication with each other. So as you get closer to the singularity, light cones lose communication with each other as well. And they lose communication as some power of t, which in this, you know, sort of logarithmic coordinate is basically exponential.
So yeah. Finding a causal domain with a spike is rare?
Well, so...
compared to the size of the causal domains?
Like. Oh, yeah, so right, exactly. So that's right. So in fact, you could argue that if you take a generic observer hitting the singularity, that he's not going to hit it at a spike point, right? I mean, so in that sense, you know, BKL are you know, right almost everywhere. Yeah. You had a question?
Yeah, I think my question is to what extent can we say that the spatial derivatives are negligible in proximity to these spikes?
Yeah, so that's right. So that's an excellent question. So the idea is that the spike is narrowing, and in fact it's narrowing exponentially, but therefore its derivative is growing exponentially, but it's also being multiplied by an exponential factor. And so, you know, a negative exponential factor. And so the question is, which wins? And the answer is that the decaying exponential factor actually wins. So even though the derivatives are growing exponentially, they are still negligible in the field equations because they're multiplied by an exponential that goes down even faster. So now let me fast forward to the general case, right? I mean, we do stuff with symmetry because it's easier and it gives us a feel for how things look. But we also want to be able to tackle the case that has no symmetry at all. So how do we do that? Well, in particular, one of the things that we want is some variables that don't behave that badly as we go to the singularity. Right? So in particular, curvature is going to blow up. Even metric components are going to go to zero, like some power. We don't, you know, really want to deal with those. But it turns out that there's a nice, simple way of being able to write stuff in terms of variables that don't blow up at all. And if we go back to, say, the case of cosmology, we certainly have, you know, as you go towards the Big Bang, that the Hubble constant is blowing up. And we also have that the density is blowing up. But the density is not blowing up any faster than the Hubble constant squared. And so you could imagine, you know, some sort of rescale density where you divide by the square of the Hubble constant, and that quantity might be nice near the singularity. Similarly, for the case where you have things that are being anisotropic and inhomogeneous, you can take all sorts of things that are blowing up, like the anisotropy, and you can divide that by the average expansion, and now you get scale invariant variables. So the basic idea here is that you take the general case with no symmetry, you write things in what are called the tetrad formalism. So the idea is that you take a set of four orthonormal vectors, and your basic variables are the commutators of those vectors. So in particular, I think I'm losing the pointer here. This H is basically the sort of average expansion of your time vector. This sigma is the shear of that quantity, and then there are these other things that have to do with the commutators of the space vectors, which are sort of less intuitive, but you can basically think of them as being kind of spatial curvatures. So all of these things are going to blow up as you go towards the singularity, but they're not going to blow up any faster than the average expansion. So you make scale invariant variables by dividing all of these quantities by the expansion. And so the idea is that now you can go towards the singularity in a way that where the variables that you're using are still not going to blow up. So the Einstein equation basically is now just going to be some evolution equations and constraint equations involving these variables. And to make sense of the BKL conjecture, one wants to pick a particular slicing, but in contrast to the Gaudi case, there's no symmetry to help us figure out which slicing to choose. And it turns out that one thing that works very well is to just use constant mean curvature slicing. So again, in analogy with cosmology, the usual t equals constant slicing and Robertson Walker are constant mean curvature, and that mean curvature is basically the Hubble constant. So you can think of these slicings as being the sort of analogy of the cosmological slices for a completely inhomogeneous and anisotropic spacetime. If someone handed you a general spacetime with no symmetries, no homogeneities, and said, give me the slices that are as close to Robertson Walker as you can find, this would be the answer. Okay, now in particular, so I said that nothing's blowing up, but at least not in terms of these scale invariant variables. But certainly curvatures are going to blow up because this is a singularity. And the thing is that if you take, say your favorite curvature scalar, like say the square or the Weyl tensor, and if we choose one of these exponential times so that the expansion is e to the minus t, right here now the singularity is being approached as t goes to minus infinity, then the curvature scalar is going to be some function of the scale invariant variables that has an e to the minus 4t multiplying it. So in general, unless these scale invariant variables have a very special value, as you approach the singularity, curvatures will be blowing up everywhere. And they'll be blowing up, basically at the same rate. Okay, so what do we get when we do these simulations? Well, we basically find the same sort of thing that was found in the Gaudi case, namely that spatial derivatives become less important than time derivatives. Although again, there will be sort of generic places where one form spikes, but here the dynamics is slightly different. What we find at each spatial point is that the dynamics becomes of the sort where you can almost think of it. So again, it's sort of helpful to think of a cosmological analogy. You could think of singularity formation as being, sort of like the Big Bang cosmology being run in reverse. Only now what you have to do is you have to think about three different scale factors, one for each of the three directions. So you can have, say you're contracting at this rate in this direction, at another rate in this direction, another rate in this direction. Sure.
Yeah.
Right. So for the full metric, you can still at each point you have this sort of time vector, and you can think of it shear, right? So those three expansion rates are basically going to be the three eigenvalues of the shear tensor.
Right.
In a sort of Robertson Walker run backwards, everything is contracting, at exactly the same rate in three different directions. In this case, what you find is that only two directions are contracting. One direction is actually expanding, even though you're going towards a singularity. And even worse than that, at a particular point, rapidly, the things change. The thing that used to be contracting will now, one of the things that used to be contracting will now start expanding. The expanding direction will start contracting. It'll do it at these different rates. And so what you get is a sequence of epochs where you have basically constant contraction rates punctuated by short bounces where those contraction rates change. Yeah, you had a question? Similar to that. Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute, but yes. Yeah. You had a question?
Yes. So thinking back to the slide where you showed those tetrads, now spatial commutator equations The right side looked like the structural constants of a Yankee model.
Yeah.
So isn't that still kind of spatial homogeneous in the sense that it's same as a mini superspace thing? So it's not more general.
Well, so by design, these variables were designed to look like Bianchi models, but because you get different values of these variables at each point, it's completely inhomogeneous. However, because the spatial derivatives become negligible as you approach the singularity, what you find is that at each spatial point, you're back to the dynamics of a Bianchi model. So the space-time is completely general, right? There's no assumption of homogeneity being made. But because the spatial derivatives become negligible as you approach the singularity, it turns out that you recover the dynamics of the homogeneous model, but a different homogeneous model at each spatial point.
So how many, I guess, true degrees of freedom per point are you saying?
Exactly the same as in GR. That doesn't change at all. It's just that the way their dynamics behave, it's almost as if you have a sort of separate cosmology at a point. But again, we're sort of used to that from Robertson Walker, right? Near the Big Bang, points decouple, not because of anything funny going on, but just that, you know, when you're sufficiently near the singularity, your light cone doesn't intersect anybody else's light cone. And it's basically the same thing here. Yes. Yeah. This is exactly what's called MixMaster. So in particular, the dynamics of these spatially homogeneous models had been extensively studied, and this you know sort of series of epochs punctuated by bounces is a characteristic of how the homogeneous models behave. And so other than the spikes. One can basically say that the dynamics near a general singularity is essentially a separate homogeneous model at each spatial point.
Which gives you which direction the expansion.
Right, but again, you can choose that however you like, and you still get sort of this behavior as you approach the singularity. Yeah, so you could, well, you can certainly arrange very special conditions, right? I mean, you could arrange the sort of shear that you get, in Minkowski space-time or, a little region, which it looks like that or something like that. If you work really hard, you can get something that doesn't quite look like this, but this is what things look like in general.
Right.
And in fact, so just to sort of show you a picture, so this is sort of sitting at one spatial point. For sort of funny historical reasons, this time coordinate is chosen so that t equals minus infinity goes to the singularity. And I plotted this one versus t rather than minus t. So you actually have to sort of read this from right to left. So here are the initial conditions, and what you find is that things, and this is at a particular spatial point, these are the three eigenvalues of the rescaled shear tensor. So the idea is that you have some initial conditions and things slosh around, and then they settle down into a state where for a while, those rescaled eigenvalues of shear are constant, and then there are these short bounces when they change to some other value, and then short bounces where they change to some other value, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is the generic behavior, right? And so this is why it's taffy rather than spaghetti. You do get compressed in two directions and stretched in one, but what that direction is suddenly changes, and eventually, each direction has its own share of compression and expansion. It keeps bouncing.
the microleptic, it looks like they're getting longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they are getting longer. Yeah.
And that keeps on going, it's worse?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, but what is getting longer?
The time between bounces, at least in this logarithmic, yeah. Yeah.
Is that just an artifact, the fact that you put the singularity at minus infinity?
Yeah, sure. So, right. I mean, it's certainly in terms of proper time of the observer, these bounce times are getting ridiculously short, right? Because there's only a finite amount of time to the singularity, but there's actually an infinite number of bounces.
I mean, you would think that this is the characteristic time would be the Hubble time for these changes, because that's the one time.
Right, and that's why this sort of logarithmic time gives that characteristic time.
So is that characteristic, does that get shorter or like, that gets longer as you get closer to the
If you were doing that exactly, I think you would get constant intervals in logarithmic time.
Is that right?
It gets a little bit longer, but it's not a huge effect. I mean, the dominant thing is the sort of, you know, intervals in logarithmic time. Okay, so now what is causing these bounces? So that gets back to your question about spatial derivatives. So basically, these sort of analogs of the shear, these kind of spatial Christoffel symbols, are at any given time, two of them are decaying and one of them is growing. As long as they are all negligible, you just have these time periods where the shear is constant. But eventually, the growing one gets big enough to cause a change in the shear, the bounce. And then that growing one, during that change, also becomes negligible. It becomes one of the decaying ones. And then things are stable for a while until another eigenvalue of the spatial curvature grows. And then so on and so forth. So that's what this bounce mechanism is. Now it turns out that you can characterize these eigenvalues of shear by a single number, right? The shear tensor is trace free, so its eigenvalues have to add up to zero. During each of these bounces, there's basically a constraint on the square of the shear, so they can be described by essentially one number, which is basically the ratio of the sort of biggest eigenvalue to the next biggest eigenvalue. And it turns out that one number obeys a nice simple rule, which Bilinski, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz also found many years ago. This quantity U goes to U minus 1 if it's bigger than 2, and to 1 over U minus 1 if it's between 1 and 2. So that's the thing that tells you what went before the bounce determines what goes after the bounce. And so this U-map is a property of homogeneous cosmologies. And again, you can check to see that it really works in the inhomogeneous cosmologies by plotting it this way. And sure enough, it goes down by 1. And then when it's between 1 and 2, it has this other behavior. OK, so now, since I've been talking about all this homogeneous stuff, I should show you some dependence on space. So this is one of those eigenvalues of the shear, now in a movie. Sure enough, you see it quickly bounces to another one. But if you look really closely, you can see that one of those places sort of takes a little bit longer to bounce. And in fact, that's actually an artifact with limited resolution. Really, that one part in the middle doesn't bounce at all and is stuck in the old phase. So these spikes are not just a property of Gaudi. They happen in general. And so here's another picture of sort of the same thing now going through a slice. And sure enough, you know, there's one point that gets hung up. It turns out that there's one exception to this matter doesn't matter stuff. And that has to do with either scalar fields or P equals rho perfect fluids. Their energy grows as fast as the effective energy of shear. And so near a singularity, they're not negligible. So now I'm going to show you the result for simulations involving these sorts of things. And it turns out that the behavior is similar, except that there's a last bounce. So here I've, hang on a second. Here I've given this as a function now of minus t, so going towards the singularity is this way. And again, these are these eigenvalues of the rescaled shear. And sure enough, they bounce around, but then after a while, they stop bouncing. So this, so it, since nature does contain at least one fundamental scalar field, we can actually expect that as we approach singularities. Well, well, okay, yeah, that's a good point. If nature contains at least one fundamental scalar field, then behavior near the singularity is a little bit simpler. There will be a last bounce, and whatever the shears are at that last bounce at a particular point, that's what they'll be all the way to the singularity. I should mention, though, that you know, sort of, even though formally GR has this infinite sequence of bounces in the vacuum case when you approach the singularity, after a fairly small number of bounces, since this is a logarithmic time, you quickly reach the Planck scale, and then you don't trust classical GR anyway. So, so in practice, one should really just think of a finite number of bounces anyway, because after a finite number of bounces, either some scalar field prevents further bounces, or quantum gravity takes over and tells us something different. Okay, so now I want to say a little bit about resolving these spikes. So the spikes get exponentially narrower, and so that means they become harder and harder to resolve. And so what you would like is to use some computer method that adds extra resolution where it's needed. In other words, you'd like to use adaptive mesh refinement. So this is something that Franz Pretorius and I are doing in collaboration. So far, we've looked only in the 1D case, where it's easy to add lots of points, and only for a cosmological scenario involving some funny scalar potential. We're looking at the 2D case, where you know it takes more computer resources because you have to resolve everywhere, and we expect to have some results about this soon.
So in 2D, is our spikes like lines or
funny? Lines, curves in general, right? I mean, so the basic idea is that because they're caused by the level surfaces where something vanishes, they're always surfaces of codimension one. So points in one spatial dimension.
One number.
Okay, so now, since I basically running out of time, let me briefly say stuff about null singularities, and then I'll end. So there is a conjecture due to Werner Israel and Eric Poisson, and developed by various other people, that a different kind of singularity forms in at least part of the interior of a black hole. And the point is the following. If you look at the Kerr metric, in addition to its outer horizon, it has an inner horizon. That inner horizon is a null surface. But the metric is known to be unstable on the inner horizon. And so if you perturb the Kerr metric slightly, as any collapsing black hole will do, you should get some sort of singularity. And what Israel and Poisson conjecture is that that singularity retains its null character. So the inner horizon is null. You perturb it, it becomes a singularity. But they conjecture that the singularity is still null, not space-like, like this BKL stuff. Since then, there have been a bunch of mathematical results due to De Fermos and some of his collaborators that establish that these null singularities really exist. And at least in the spherical case, there have been some numerical simulations that show they exist, at least when you have spherical perturbations of Reissner-Nordström. We'd like to know whether these singularities, these null singularities, exist in a general case. So I'm going to end with my to-do list, and part of the purpose of my visit here. So one part of the to-do list is to resolve the spikes in more than one dimension. This is work in progress with Pretorius. Another part of the to-do list, which I haven't said much about, is that these numerical simulations of singularities are done for convenience using periodic boundary conditions. So that means that they're really singularities in a closed cosmology. But we'd like to be sure that these also describe the singularities formed in gravitational collapse. So another thing on the to-do list is to get rid of the periodic boundary conditions and see whether things still work that way. And then finally, the last thing on the to-do list is to simulate null singularities beyond spherical symmetry. And Luis has given me lots of good advice about how to do that. Next week, when I get home, I'm going to try to put that advice into practice. And maybe next time I come here, I'll have some actual simulations of that to show. So the basic conclusion is that numerical simulations can give us some understanding of singularities, but there's still plenty left to do. So thank you. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, isn't this, it seems to me that the numerical question at least is ill-defined, because singularity is obviously something that is a singularity. So even, analytically, you cannot really resolve it, let alone numerics. So before you hit the singularity, the numerics should break down, right? So the question of what is, say, if I want to say this, the singularity of space time back, I should have a practical definition of singularity, the mathematical definition cannot really help.
The idea, in terms of mathematics, you can have plenty of singular functions. And so you might say, this function is singular, we can't really say anything about it. But that's not true. You can say a lot about singular functions. In particular, you can say, at what rate do they blow up? What's their dynamics near where they blow up? Numerically, this dodge of introducing a logarithmic time is actually very helpful, because the idea is that for the purposes of the numerical simulation, you've pushed the singularity off to an infinite time coordinate, sure, and you read off the behavior of the singularity, as the asymptotic behavior of the solutions. Right. Yeah. That's all this is. This is all the behavior as you approach the singularity.
Is the singularity a space time for now? And that's a statement about the singularity itself, not about as you approach the singularity. Because you could have non-surfaces that approach singularity, or you could have space-like surfaces that approach.
Okay. So let's see. Is there some chalk?
Yeah. Right under the screen.
Yes. Just behind the screen, there's.
Oh, here. Okay. Perfect. Yeah, so let's draw a picture, right? So that's a space-like singularity, right? This is a null singularity, okay? So you might say, how am I ever supposed to sort of read this off from a numerical simulation? If the numerical simulation only tells me the behavior as I approach the singularity, how am I ever supposed to find the nature of the singularity itself? So, but the point is that once you have a numerical simulation of a space-time, you have a bunch of the properties of that space-time. And so one question is, is there anything that we can read off from the numerical simulation that will tell us the difference between this situation and this situation? And so the idea is that if I have two observers who hit the singularity, then in this case, once they get sufficiently close to the singularity, their future light cones become disjoint. Whereas here, if I have two observers who hit the singularity, this one, no matter how close they get, this one is always in the future light cone of the other. Right? So given the results of a numerical simulation, you can always say, all right, well, let me consider two observers, say in free fall, who hit the singularity, and let me trace out what their light cones are, and let me see whether they become disjoint.
So my point is that your simulation never actually goes all the way to the singularity. It stops at some point before you hit the singularity.
Sure.
And then you might, basically the light cones might miss each other, for example, just because you haven't continuously measured enough. If you have continued enough, then the light cone of one observer would have actually hit the other observer, but you haven't continued the simulation enough, so that's why they miss each other.
Right, right. So if the idea were, I mean, so the idea is that you hope to get not just a bunch of numerical data, but also to be able to read off from the results of the simulation what you expect the asymptotic properties to be, right? And so the idea is that if you can do that, then you have not just the simulation, but an actual asymptotic property, and that asymptotic property takes you all the way to the singularity. But in more practical terms, I want to remind you again that after a relatively small number of these bounces, you reach the Planck scale of curvature. And at that point, you're not supposed to trust GR anyway. So I claim that my simulations can already take me from the solar mass scale to the Planck scale. And you know, beyond that, you're not supposed to trust what I tell you anyway.
That could be a sharper statement that you define singularity as where curvature, where Hirschsprung scalar is Planck or some
yeah.
number. And if that you take that as a definition, then you can make a statement about that.
Right.
Right. And so I think that's at least that's a physical statement, right? But otherwise, but yeah. So I guess I think that I would put it that way then. I mean,
okay.
Right. But you define the boundary of your space time as somewhere that basically the curvature reaches some fixed scale. But then that tells you whether I should just stop my simulation, basically.
Yeah.
Right. So some place may have to stop it earlier than others. That's the thing. That it's not that I just pick some foliations, some time coordinate, and run everywhere together. It's something. It's that somewhere I have to run it longer than somewhere else.
Well, I mean, other than a little bit of local variation, the nice thing about these scale invariant variables and the
right.
choice of constant mean curvature slicing is that you basically have about the same curvature everywhere on the slice.
Well, I mean, constant mean curvature is not extrinsic curvature, not. So
yeah,
it's
but
a different
but,
type of curvature.
Right, but the point is that for the use of scale invariant variables, the Kretschmann scalar is basically mean curvature squared times some function of the scale invariant variables. And that function is of order one everywhere. So it's not that the curvature is exactly the same everywhere, but on a given slice, it might be, you know, three times the Planck scale over here and half the Planck scale over here, that it's still, you know, more or less the same scale.
That's an important question, because if you want to ask that question that does the light cone of this guy miss that guy or not,
mm-hmm.
if I continued it a bit longer, I might have not missed it, but now that I've continued it less, now I miss it. So that's...
Yeah, but I mean, for the purposes of quantum gravity, it's not as though the Planck scale is a sharp cutoff either, right? You don't say, you know, we get to trust classical GR for curvature up to 0.999, you know, times the Planck scale, and then, you know, at 1.0001 times the Planck scale, you know, we can't do that anymore, and we switch to quantum gravity. So I claim that I can already simulate us into the quantum gravity regime, and after that, you know, somebody else has to tell us what's going on. Yeah, using different methods. Right. Right, right. This works a lot better when you know, there's sort of a bunch of people, you know, doing string theory and or loop quantum gravity in the audience, because then I can just, you know, sort of point to them and say, okay, you know, now it's your guy's turn. So okay. Yeah.
So he's just thinking about the worst case. That there are situations when the light cones do intersect within the simulation, and in those situations, you can say something very clear.
Sure, but the point is that it's like cosmology in the sense that the closer you get to the singularity, the narrower the reach of each observer's light cone is. So you figure that, you know, given two observers sufficiently far away, there ought to be a time, you know, when they're close enough to the singularity that they've lost causal contact with each other. Other questions? think I've probably taken up too much of your time anyway. So anyway, thanks for your attention.
Continue our lines, yeah.
Yeah.